Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And there's days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
Can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City,
the Shambhala New York podcast.
And this is the cooking podcast. I'm Trevor, your host. Yeah. I know. I'm just seeing if you're paying attention. This is Dave, your host, as always. And this is the Meditation in the City podcast. It's just because we're talking about right speech today. Right speech, wrong speech. These are very foundational Buddhist ideas, practices, the practice of conscious communication. And if you consume a fraction of the political news that's out there, I'm sure it's an experience that you have to wonder at the value of right speech versus wrong speech. So that's today's talk. This was a talk given by Shastri Ethan Nichtern at our weekly Dharma gathering just a couple of weeks ago. Ethan Nichtern is the author of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. And he's got a new book coming out in September. It's called The Dharma of the Princess Bride, What the Coolest Fairy Tale of Our Time Can Teach Us About Buddhism and Relationships. It's on Amazon for pre-order now. Check it out. Comes out in September. So let's do it. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming classes and weekend retreats. In particular, our introductory meditation course, which is called Meditation in Everyday Life, begins Thursday evening, May 4th. Also, another great start is Shambhala Training Weekend 1, which is happening the weekend of May 5th. So you can check both of those out on the website and register. And now, let's talk about right speech.
So I really wanted to talk tonight about expression, speech. One of the really important practices, conscious communication is an entire practice from the earliest days of Buddhism, so important that the founder of the tradition, Buddha, the historical Buddha, put speech as one of the eight main practices of awakening. So it's at least one of the eight most important things that a human being can do. Wanted to talk about that in this very interesting, to put it mildly, era of human expression. And I thought to start us off, we could have a little interactive piece, which is based on a listening and expressing very simple meditative exercise that we do in this tradition and other traditions I've studied in, sometimes called the dyad practice, which is just a paired listening and expressing practice. So it's a very structured, it's not a conversation. There's one listener and there's one speaker, and then you switch roles after about 3 minutes. And just as a way to kind of wet our whistle, so to speak, about what does it look like to make speech a mindfulness practice? So this is going to be, it's not going to be the deepest existential conversation you've ever had. Maybe it will, I don't know, but I don't want to promise anything. It's really just a practice of listening to another person. I hope that was okay. Not too torturous. It didn't feel like a room full of people in a lot of pain. So the formal practice is of communication in Buddhist terms is Sanskrit, it's samyakvach, which means something like appropriate or skillful, and then speech, right? So speech in the Iron Age in northern India, where Siddhartha Gautama lived, speech literally meant speech. That was what you had, was your expressed, verbally expressed. I don't know if they had sign language of any form at that point. But they did not use written language broadly, right? So it really referred to this act of communication that a person had that was somewhat maybe rare. And so that's one of the issues of, I think, looking at practice of conscious communication or right speech. Oftentimes this word samyak is translated as right, and it's not the most literal translation, more like skillful or appropriate is used. So it's interesting to try to translate that as a practice just into an era of human life where speech is, well, you could say this one of two ways. You could say in an era where speech is greatly enriched, because there are so many ways we can do it, you know. So many, anybody, my father sometimes, when I was a little kid, my father's a musician and also teaches Buddhism, but when I was a little kid, he had a period where he sold high-end musical synthesizers to recording studios. And in the early 1980s, these would cost like $50,000 to $150,000. And he said, now, you know, you probably have the same amount of power in your laptop with GarageBand, right? So anybody can make music now. Anybody can express themselves that way. Anybody can have a Twitter account, right? Anybody can have a blog. Anybody can comment. Anybody control. So very quickly, this notion of an enriched experience of more ways of speaking also collides with the idea that speech has been greatly cheapened, because the sort of like per unit meaning of any expression as it becomes more and more ubiquitous goes down. So it's a little of both. I guess it depends whether you're in a glasses half full, half empty mood on a given day. Like, is awakening possible in the 21st century? Can we use technology mindfully? It's like, well, if it was possible in the BC world, then of course it's possible now. It's just a different arena. And I'm a glasses half full kind of person. Not historically. It just figured out it's actually a more accurate and helpful way to try to be as often as possible. It's where these teachings come from. At least it's a more complicated practice, speech and expression. And I think it's also complicated by the fact that not everybody in this world has a Buddhist view that speech is a practice of connection and awakening. Not every Buddhist always has that view, right? Some people think, and there are whole systems based on the idea that speech is not a practice, it is a strategy for winning something. Speech is spin. Speech is a way to turn an argument in your direction, or speech is a way to gain praise for your entity, for your work, for your brand. So that complicates things. And with this complexity, you know, all of the practices of right speech that the Buddha taught, they rely on two things that don't always exist in the modern world. One is simplicity of exchange, that you could encounter another traveler on the path of life and you could think about what you wanted to express, right? And also that you trusted the mutual intention of that exchange, you know? So, like, if anybody did that, and I hope you didn't, because this feels like a trusting space, it's sort of like our little sangha or community, but if anybody did that listening practice worried that your partner was going to go blog what you said as a way to make you lose your job or beat you in an election or gain a resume title or get a credit instead of you. It would make it much harder to do the practices that are traditionally the four main practices of appropriate or skillful speech in early Buddhism, which are trying to express that which is true. That's a nice practice. Just if something is not true, don't say it. Right? Then trying to express what is true in a way that is gentle, meaning that isn't overly harsh, that isn't going to knock the person out so that they can't use the truth in a way that they can incorporate it into their life in a meaningful way, in a helpful way. Trying not to speak divisively. So this is where like negative gossip comes in. Like not telling stories about people to get people just to dislike them more, so, right? And also speaking when it's necessary, right? And that's an interesting one. Anybody who does a longer retreat, like in this tradition, we often have week-long or sometimes even month-long retreats where you practice a good amount of silence, which definitely reframes what do I need to actually say here? Even to get through a whole day, what do I need to say? Right. So all of those are useful practices if there's a sense that you're living in a simple world where people can connect and listen and express, and you're living in a trusting situation. You can view the person you are connecting with as what the Buddhists, I'm one of them, but would call Sangha, community, right? So that there's some like, this is not going to screw up my ranking in something to tell you I feel sad. There is a person who says sad quite a lot in the social media sphere. I don't think that person knows what that word means. Right, but it would be nice to just trust that if I say something to you honestly and kindly, it would be received. And so the question is, how do we practice right speech in a world where speech is not a typical practice, where people do not share the sense of like, I get why that leads to awakening. I'm with you. I'm not here to manipulate your speech. I'm not here to use it against you or spin it, etc. And this isn't always possible, but I think listening as a practice is the way, and it's one of the main tools that we have to turn a relationship towards a trusting relationship. So what did it feel like to listen? Was it easy? Was it hard? Were there particular obstacles? Did it feel good to listen in general? Did it feel like a burden, like just one more person? Just one more person I need to receive this diatribe from? Sometimes it feels that way, right? I don't know. If you do anything similar to what I do, it can sometimes, it's like, oh, another one. (Laughter) I know there's some people in the room who have those experiences in your work or your home life, so. But I'll take the blame for it right now. There's something about this space, maybe because you're like, okay, I'm coming to a space where people are trying to be kind or mindful. You know, if somebody just got up on the subway and said, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to practice mindful listening now. Turn to your neighbor. It would really take an urban bodhisattva, an urban Buddha, to be able, you would turn to that figure and they would somehow, through charm or through something, but things like this have happened, right, in the world. What is it that would make those people say, okay, I'm going to do this practice? So it's interesting to think about establishing trust through listening. And so that's why when I was writing about speech as a practice in The Road Home, I thought should really look at the obstacles to listening, the same way we think about the obstacles to meditation, the obstacles to compassion, the obstacles to working with anger or jealousy. And there, it's pretty interesting to study why it's hard to listen. Most of the world, I would say, gets a close to failing grade at listening most of the time. So if you could even become a C-plus listener, people would think you were such an amazing person. Has anybody done that? Does anybody feel like, okay, I'm not that great at listening, but I need a little less friends calling on me? This is actually what happened to my mother. Is my mother was a painter, and then, you know, was a struggling artist in New York City, but she was also a Buddhist, and she was the friend that all of her friends would call for advice. So she was like, I need to. So when in her 50s, she went back to school and got her MSW and became a therapist, right? She's just like, okay, I need to turn this listening into something. So what is it that makes listening so hard? It's interesting. One is the same thing that makes mindfulness hard. You just go somewhere else. You just get distracted. And so I think just like with meditation, practicing coming back when you're in conversation is a really helpful practice. Just that same rhythm, that sort of wax on, wax off rhythm of the mind wanders, you just bring it back. Somebody's telling you about their day, you start thinking about what you're going to watch on Netflix, thinking back to the person in front of you. I think a deeper one in this era obstacle is that there's a fear that if I listen fully, it's really going to be painful. Like to listen to another person say something that is hurtful to you or hurtful to people you care about or that you know is hurtful to them is painful, isn't it? And so to really acknowledge that, like, sometimes I don't listen just because it would be too painful, you know? And that's a really honest obstacle to acknowledge. It's a really, I think, self-compassionate obstacle to acknowledge, but it is an obstacle. Right? And sometimes we don't listen because we just want to tell our story. Start listening. The person's telling us about what they're writing about. And you're like, yeah, that's great. Here's what I'm writing about. So wanting to tell your own story. And the subtlest form, and I think this way of looking at the world, of why listening is hard is because you want to help the person. So you want to tell them how to fix their issue. You want to give advice. And the beautiful thing about that deep listening exercise is you're not allowed to do that. So I don't know if you noticed those moments where you just wanted to, with the best possible intention, just say, I feel that too, and here's, let me give you the name of a person. Do you have Amazon Prime? You can order this right now. And you can't do that. And sometimes that actually, that desire to give advice before it's requested actually stops the listening process. But I think listening as a practice is what moves situations into more trustful places. Now, I want to come back to, because the topic of this talk was right speech in the era of very, very wrong speech. That was the title of my talk. And I want to come back to what it means to listen when you're afraid that what might be said is painful, fear of pain, when that's the obstacle. Has anybody experienced this in your families or sanghas or social media platforms recently, like the question of should I block this person? Although there's a great sci-fi series that's a little disturbing called Black Mirror. And one of the episodes, it's slightly in the future, and you can literally, if you choose to block a person, they literally disappear from your vision or hearing. So they could be right there, but they're blurred out. So what does listening mean when there's a really meaningful fear of pain, like you're going to lie, or you're going to say something that's hurtful, or that's supporting something hurtful? And I think you really have two options here, and either one is a valid practice if it's a practice, if it's a conscious, intentional way of working with your mind. One is to do a temporary block. In this tradition, we don't believe in permanent blocks. That's the Bodhisattva path. But temporary blocks, I want to, the next time I talk, which is on May 9th, the title of that talk is Unconditional Love, Good Boundaries. So I want to talk more about the temporary block next time. But you could do that, or you could try to establish trust by engaging the person in a conversation that navigates around the pain. And I'll give you an example that's been a contemplation from my next book. So My next book is an attempt to write a book about relationships with the basic premise there's no such thing as a relationship expert. That's the basic premise of the book. But to do that, I wanted to bring in a little pop cultural foil. So it's a book about friendship, romance, and family, trying to study Buddhism for 30 years alongside 30 years loving The Princess Bride, which is all about friendship, romance, and family. So the notion of painful listening that I was contemplating is using one of the biggest fans in the world of the movie The Princess Bride. So do you know who is one of the big, there's many fans of the movie The Princess Bride. There's many not fans of the movie The Princess Bride, as I'm also finding out. But do you know who one of the biggest fans of this movie, like obsessive fans of this movie is? It's a person, somebody with my political, spiritual leanings may have a fear of pain in terms of listening to about other things. It's Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, former Republican presidential candidate, to the point where Princess Buttercup became a topic in one of the early Republican presidential debates, which was mind-blowing. Literally, Lindsey Graham turned to Ted Cruz and said, Princess Buttercup would not like that, Ted. You can look this up. And there's videos of him doing really good impressions of Billy Crystal's character and Mandy Patinkin's character, to the point where Mandy Patinkin, who I had the chance to talk to about the book, wrote an op-ed piece in Time about how Ted Cruz missed the whole point of The Princess Bride. Now, the contemplation, because I do have members of my own family who I think do agree with some of what Ted Cruz might believe in terms of human relationships and human society, the contemplation is, what would I do if Ted Cruz were my cousin? What would you do if you're going to see Ted Cruz is, we're all cousins, by the way. That's another part of that contemplation. That is one relationship every human being has. So what would I do? I think we would talk about The Princess Bride first. You know, establish some connection. This is based on one of my favorite quotes from Chogyam Trungpa, the founder of our tradition, that says, everybody loves something, even if it's only tortillas. So everybody loves something, even if it's only The Princess Bride. Can you find somebody else's tortilla moment? Now, this is the interesting question. What do you do with the rest of it? What do you do with the pain that lies behind this? And what do you do when there's a communication that has great consequences for the way your own life goes or the life of people you care about that cannot happen in a trusting situation, that cannot happen with two people speaking truthfully and kindly to each other and coming to some agreement about how to share space? What do you do in the era of wrong speech, where it all feels like spin and strategy and winning and et cetera? I don't know. But I can tell you this, just because you study Buddhism or practice meditation does not make you stupid about cause and effect. And it doesn't make you think that cause and effect is inconsequential. In fact, it makes you really care about cause and effect. And really care about the consequences, and especially in this practice, studying the consequences of expression. So I do think that spiritual people, rather than just saying, like, may they be happy, that is definitely the first thing to say. But that can be spun too. That is spun all the time. May they be happy is spun into, like, okay, but what do we do about this conflict? What do we do about practicing awakening and truthfulness in the so-called post-truth era? Which, by the way, there's no such thing as the post-truth era from a Buddhist standpoint. And we may have to enter spaces of expression more strategically. Listening is always a good practice, but sometimes it's not available. It doesn't actually protect truth alone. Alone listening does not protect truth. So I really think mindful people have to learn how the spin, if we want to stop the spin, we have to learn how the spin works. And that has to be part of our practice, too. How our own spin works, that's always where, right? Because we're spinning all the time. That was what the Buddha first learned, is he was telling himself all these stories about how suffering was really pleasure. No, 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 no. It's cool. Just, no, if you grasp a little harder, maybe you'll be happy. And at a certain point, he had to notice the inner spin and say, grasping does not lead to happiness. That's spin. That's not truth. Greed does not lead to group happiness. That's spin from the Buddhist standpoint. So, but how does that spin work? We really have to study it if we're going to unravel it. And so I really commend you to practice listening, but also to practice realizing that right speech looks a little bit different if a trusting Sangha relationship has been established versus if it hasn't. And if you can do anything to establish trust, do it. But if you can't, that doesn't mean be silent. That doesn't mean cede ground to untruth. So it's an interesting era we're living in. It's a beautiful time in some ways, and it's a very painful time. Does anybody ever feel that sense of like, I just really want to stop the BS and just, can we just talk about honestly what's going on? That's always a first moment in awakening, is when you feel like, ah, just what's really happening here? Like I just, last week, I just wanted, look, here's the deal. Militarizing stuff is profitable. And that's part of this. I just, like Friday night, I just really wanted that to be like, did anybody else be like, ah? And so just as much as this path starts with the desire to be truthful to ourselves, which comes out of frustration, I think speech in a social setting has to come out of some loving frustration with spin. So I think that's all I wanted to say. And we can have about 10 or so minutes of discussion. Spin. Punditry.
Hi. I just wanted to clarify, are you saying that we need to meet spin with better spin, or did I miss? Okay.
No. We need to really understand the structure of spin.
Got it.
Because as soon as you enter a non-trusting communication, both sides are going to be assuming that the other one's spinning. And so it's just studying, like, how does that work, right? And then there might be some aspects of spin. This is also part of our tantric heritage, that within confusion, there's always wisdom. So, like, if spin is popular, there's probably some aspect of spin that's useful. Like, for example, the ability to say the same thing again and again, which you learn as a teacher. At first, you're like, I don't want to repeat myself. And then you realize that if you don't repeat the points of your talk, so right speech being a super important part of our awakening practice, right? That it's more complicated than it used to be, that establishing trust through listening is key, that when you can't establish trust, we need to learn how spin works. To repeat that is helpful. And the spinners are really good at repeating stuff. Study that.
And is there value in listening to it then? Because I find it so painful to listen to that I have just avoided it because I get so angry.
Yeah. So does your, and here's the really $64,000 question, does the avoidance feel like protection and preparation to enter awareness later, or does it feel like I just want to get away?
That's a very good question.
Yeah. I mean, the way to test that question is to just lean in slightly. I mean, I visit FoxNews.com every day. I want to study the narrative. I want to study the structure. It's a really interesting structure. So it's interesting to, you know, it's also interesting to meet something that feels painful with a fresh perspective. One time, Chogyam Trungpa was asked what awakening feels like. He was asked a bunch of times. And on this occasion, his answer was, it's like smelling tobacco for the first time. Which is a super sort of riddle answer, but tobacco is something that's can be quite harmful. But it's the direct experience of it, free from concept, free from presumption, can be a different experience, right? And it can bring some kind of wisdom. I don't think that means you get addicted to cigarettes, right? Because he doesn't say it's like addiction to cigarettes means you're not smelling the tobacco anymore, basically. That's what addiction is. You cease. The dopamine rush has actually replaced, in a lot of sense, the actual experience. You just know that going through the motion leads to a certain chemical response, right? So what if you actually had to smell the tobacco for the first time? So what if you went to Fox News, or I travel a fair amount, so the next time I'm in an airport, this is interesting. You'll notice some narrative structures, some emotional structures at play. You know, it's an interesting thing to study. It's not going to go away on its own. You know, that's the other thing about samsara in general. It's not like, oh, maybe someone else will take care of this. You know, you know, someone else is going to take care of this is a very 2008 way of thinking, to be honest. And in my humble opinion, that was a pretty great person, but wasn't really able to take on the karma of a whole country. And it was asking way too much to expect that. So no one else is going to take care of spin. Yeah.
I had a question about your description of non-divisiveness as being one of the tenets of right speech.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, towards the end of the talk, you talked about not ceding ground to untruth.
Yeah.
So it seems like that could be very divisive in the moment. It feels like there's a dichotomy.
Yeah. This practice really developed, and I think historical context is important within... So the historical Buddha, he had lay students, and he even had leaders of tribal regions, kings who were his students, but his main sangha, people had left their caste and their class behind and become monks and later nuns. And so all of it was a way of working with the space of sangha. So it's basically... telling the truth, but doing it in a way that the sangha doesn't feel unnecessarily severed, right? Which is what gossip is. It's like, did you hear what Laura was saying about you? You know? And you're like, what? And even if Laura was talking about you, that could... So it could be truthful. But its main function is to create further power struggles. And... So then the question is, in a non-trusting environment, in a sangha that doesn't view itself as a sangha, right, how do we tell the truth in a way that acknowledges there already are divisions, in a way that doesn't create further chasms? Right? In a way that at least has an intention to bring people together, to commonize some understanding. Yeah.
I remember reading somewhere that although optimists live longer, pessimists see the world more truthfully.
Mm.
So I was wondering if you could comment upon that in terms of, you know, we want to see the glass half full. That seems to be the way we want to go. But on the other hand, if we're not really seeing reality.
Yes, yes. So what's interesting about this is that evolutionary biology would say the exact opposite. That our sort of makeup, because our nervous system came about in a much more predatory environment, that our makeup is such that our nervous system is set to over experience potential threats. So that our sort of, you know, inheritance from the early days of humanity, and then there's all other studies of inherited trauma across generations where there was oppression or conflict, but we actually see the world inaccurately because we see it as more threatening than it is. So just, you know, put that in your fresh tobacco pipe and smoke it. What I would say is the people I want to give a big shout out to are not the pessimists, but the skeptics. The ones who really have that feeling of like, I really want to know what's going on here. Like, what's really going on? Don't give me a easy pat answer. Like, what is really going on? And so that, if that's part of being a pessimist, then I agree that that's got an accuracy and a curiosity. But see, the skeptic in my book also has a kind of inquisitiveness, a curiosity, which is very optimistic, because it thinks there's something beautiful there. And I'll give you one more, just from within the arena of The Princess Bride, because I like this dharma. William Goldman, who wrote, screenwriter and writer of the book The Princess Bride, was quoted as saying, "Cynics are simply thwarted romantics." So I like that too. I do think there's reason for optimism, even if it's just rebalancing the idea that a saber-toothed tiger is not going to eat us, which is the way our system often maps, like, fear that we might not make rent this month, is we often experience that as a potential tiger going to eat us. And so from that standpoint, it's nice to just, at that moment, connect with breath, connect with a sip of water or tea or whatever is your drink of choice, and just say, I'm okay. And that's the kind of optimism I'm talking about. That being a human is basically good. That's what we're talking about. But yes, skeptics, you have to be a skeptic if you want to be on this path. And if you get to, like, my dad is really, the students of Chogyam Trungpa were really well trained in sort of noticing when they or others got a little too, like, it's awesome. Just being like, are you here? It's not awesome. It's wonderful, but, like, let's actually pay attention. Let's see what's really going on. And there's real suffering in the world. So let's not use our practice to, like, go to another world. That's the other kind of, when I'm feeling a little feisty, I say, Buddhist meditation should probably be called non-transcendental meditation. We don't need more people to transcend this world. We need people to take care of it. So stay here, work with coming back to the present moment, and let's see what happens. And part of that is, a big part of that is speech. Probably bigger now than ever before. And hope to see you all soon, and good luck with your practice, and good luck with going online and expressing yourself after your practice. So maybe we could close with a bow.
Thanks, Ethan. Thanks for listening, everybody. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. Again, our Shambhala training weekend one is happening the weekend of May 5th. Meditation in the city beginning May 4th. Sorry, meditation in everyday life beginning May 4th. Write speech, everyone. Write speech. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala meditation center near you. But if you are in the New York City area, come to the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York and check out our weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, from which these talks are drawn. You can meet the teachers and the other participants live and in person, and it's a great time. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org, your questions, comments, suggestions, and have a great week.